The picking up here with slide 2.17 in the notes. The base class that we've discussed so far is very incomplete. It doesn't contain a lot of functions that you could envision somebody using date objects would need. And most of the time when you want to design a class, you do want to try and make it complete within reason and the context of the problem and that you're working upon. You don't want, if there are a lot of functions or a lot of attributes or a lot of things about the object in terms of its relationship to some real world object that don't really pertain to the problem that you're solving, you wouldn't want to include that information and include member functions. That should be pretty obvious. Now, there are a few considerations that we have to undertake when we're trying to decide whether a function should be part of the class or whether it should be external to the class, whether it should be a member function or sort of a client code function. Basically, we just sort of ask ourselves these questions up here. If we use the class in other programs besides the one that we're planning on using it in, is it likely that that function would be used in both programs? And if that's the case, then it probably should be a member. It should be a member function. And the other thing, of course, is that operation really needed to hide information and sort of support the encapsulation of the class? If the answer to that question is true, then we basically include it. And you could, here's a couple obvious date member functions that are missing next and previous to give us the next date from the previous date. And of course, that's pretty trivial as long as you're in the middle of the month. But when you're at the end of the month or the beginning of the month, those functions take a little bit of code to accomplish. They would both have to take into account leap years. And so we'd have to be a little bit careful about that. Now, you can always then ask, you know, is it the responsibility of the class designer or the class user to implement those operations? Since really for those two questions here, are those operations likely to be used in various programs that the date class would be used in, and are they really sort of needed just to support the whole concept of a date because there are previous and next dates, then yes, it's really the designer's responsibility and they ought to really be added into the class. The next slide here gives you sort of a naming convention, a way of classifying class member functions in terms of what they do. There's what's called constructor operations. These are operations that sort of create and initialize an instance of an object. Destroyer, destructors, that's functions that basically destroys an object. We'll get into these here in just a moment. There's mutator functions, sometimes called transformer functions. That's just a member function. It's a non-constant member function that changes one of the private data members. That means it's mutating, it's the object, it's changing the state of the object. There's observer functions, sometimes also referred to as reporter, accessor, selector, summary. These are functions that can be and should be, for the most part, constant member functions. They are not going to be changing the state of an object. They are not going to be making any changes to any of the private data members. And then there's one called an iterator, which basically allows us to process, if an object contains multiple components, it will allow us to process them one after another, iteratively. So for our little date class there, initialize would sort of be a pseudo-mutator. Initialize would be a mutator, and you could consider it to sort of be a pseudo-constructor. But it doesn't fit the true definition of a constructor. And year is, month is, and day is, those are just all observer functions. So, in terms of constructors, now constructors are a special type of function in a class. They get executed automatically. They get executed implicitly most of the time. They get invoked without you explicitly calling them. Whenever you define an instance of an object, whenever you declare an object of a class, right at that declaration, whenever the code, the execution of your program gets down to that definition of that object, the constructor for it will fire. Now, a constructor for an object, or for a class, is a function which has the same name as the class. It has no return type. It doesn't return anything. It has no return type, not even void. There's no return type. It can take parameters, or it can be a parameterless constructor. And that's kind of a special form of a constructor. We'll get to that in a moment. So you can see here for this little example, we've got a function called DateType, the same name as our class. It takes three parameters. Now that would get added to the, that would get added in the public section of the class. We would add that prototype to the public section of the class. And then down later where our member function definitions are at, we would add this function definition for the constructor. Now we have to, of course, we still use the scope resolution operator, the two colons, to indicate that this is a member of the class, even though it has the same name as the class. The reason for that is it is possible in the language that we could have something you really shouldn't do very often, but it's actually possible. You can actually have a non-member function called DateType, which would not be a member of the DateType class. Would that be confusing? Yes, it would, so don't do it, okay, even though it's allowed. We still have to indicate that this thing is a member of the function, and they're using the colon. Then the rest of this is pretty much straightforward at that point. We are the purpose of a constructor. They sometimes have some minor auxiliary purposes, but the primary purpose of constructors is to initialize the private data members. That way, you can be ensured, the rest of the function members can be assured that any time that they receive an object or that an object invokes them, that object has been initialized. That's one of the chief advantages of objects over structures, is with these constructor functions, you never have to worry about ever accessing the data members in an uninitialized state, because there's no way that they can be in an uninitialized state. You can see what we've got here. We just checked the validity of month and day and year to make sure they're sort of valid numbers, not doing any real great amount of checking there. And then if they are valid, we just go ahead and assign them. And if they're not valid, then we assign the month, day, and year, which are those private data members of this object. What object? Well, it's whatever object has come into existence. It depends upon the definition in the code as to which object this constructor is being executed upon. And if those are not valid values, then we just go ahead and assign them some default values down there in the else clause. That's basically the purpose and the way you define constructors. That means then here on the next slide you can see we can define a couple date objects, A date and B date, and we can then in the definition, this looks just a little bit different. We can define in the definition, we can include parentheses and pass the parameters to the constructor so that we're giving it the initial values for that object. if we don't provide a constructor, the language will provide a default constructor for us. It doesn't do anything for the most part. It actually it doesn't initialize anything for us. That's why in here, primarily, we will, for every class that's considered good programming practice, for every class you create, unless you have a very darn good reason, and in this course you won't be able to think of one, okay? You have to get into some advanced design pattern programming before this ever becomes semi-useful. All of the classes that you create in this program, you will create constructors for them. That is, if you don't want to lose a lot of points on your program. You will create constructors that will initialize the data members. The default constructor that the language creates doesn't do any initialization, and the only reason it's there is so that default constructor can automatically invoke other constructors if necessary. We aren't going to get into that too much in here. So you will basically always implement your own default constructor in here. It's also possible for us to have multiple constructors within a class. Here's a little complex number class you can see up on the slide, on slide number 21. We've got two constructors. One of them has no parameters. The other one has two parameters. That essentially means we have two functions with the same name. That's allowed. That's called function overloading. There are some very detailed restrictions placed upon doing this, and you have to be a little bit careful, but it is a very useful technique. It's a very powerful programming language technique. We will be using it in here, but you have to be just a little bit careful about doing it. The parameterless constructor there is basically what's called the default constructor. It's not the default constructor that the language provides, but it's the default constructor for the class, basically. And there can only be one of them. And the other constructor there would be called a parameterized constructor. And you can see when we define objects down at the bottom, when we're defining X and Y, since X, in its definition, as its instantiation of the object X, it's followed by two parameters, two values. That, basically what happens then is the compiler checks in that class to see if there is a constructor that takes two parameters. It actually, in this case, it would first look to see if there's a constructor that takes two integers. It wouldn't find one. Then it would check to see if there's a constructor that takes just two parameters, and if there's a conversion between the two. And in this case, it can convert those two integer parameters here to the two double parameters up here, and so it goes ahead and invokes the parameterized constructor and executes it. For the second instantiation of Y, there's no parameters there, so it just looks up the default parameterless constructor in the class and executes it for the second one. Okay? Nothing really too complex about that. I basically answered the question at the bottom. Now, here are some of the rules for overloading functions. You can actually overload functions outside of classes. You better be darn careful about doing that. You better know what you're doing. There's really not going to be any use in this class to do that. When you're overloading functions inside of a class, there are all the rules that the compiler uses in order to try and match up. It basically tries to match what's called the signature of the function to another, the signature of the function call to the signature of a function prototype. The signature is the return type of the function, not the name, because obviously it's got two that are the same name, so it can't use those to match. It first checks the return type to see if they're different, and then it checks basically the parameters, and it checks the number of parameters first. If the two functions differ in the number of parameters, the compiler has an easy time figuring out one to call. If you have two functions that have the same number of parameters, name the same thing, in the same class, then it has to apply some of these other rules dealing with promotions, types. It first looks at the types. If the types are widely different, it checks to see if the types match up one-to-one with the arguments in the call. If the types don't match up, then it starts going through this promotion business to see which ones it can promote from a lower variable to a higher variable to widen them and do the conversions. Don't worry about that. In here, keep it simple. If you're going to overload member functions in a class in here, and really the only useful time in this class that I can think of that you're going to need to do that will be in two instances. One, when you're needing to overload constructors, and that's fine, because most of the time you'll want to have a default constructor that has no parameters and a parameterized constructor. And that's fine. It's easy for the compiler to figure out. You won't run into any problems like that. So make sure that if you're going to overload functions in here, the number of parameters differ between them, and then you won't have any problems. And you won't have to learn all these tough little rules here. I'm not going to test you on these little rules up here. I'm not even going to go over them because they do get to be fairly complex. Other instance of when you will need to overload functions is when we get into overloading some of the standard operators. Now, do you have to worry about this, about all these rules? If you have one function called compare in one class and another function called compare in an entirely different class, do you have to worry about these overloading rules? No. Because how will those two functions could have the exact same signature. They could have the exact same return type. They could have the exact number of parameters. And each of the parameters could be of the exact same type. And it will not cause the compiler a problem. Why?
Separated by the class.
Because they're separated by the class. Their scope is limited to the classes. So they can only be invoked by different objects. So the compiler will always be able to figure out which one you're intending it to execute. You had a question?
Yeah, one thing was right now. So if we wanted to use some different classes and same everything, would we every time say, for example, our class, and then the scope, and then the function name, and then can't we just say the function name, can't we declare them both global and then just use the function name and the same name, for example?
Are you talking about overloading non-class member functions?
Yes,
you can do that. And it just gets into what I can say. You can do that. If they are within a class, you still have to define them. You can't define class member functions globally, if that's what you're trying to do, by leaving off the :: scope resolution operator in the class name. You can't do that. That means you're defining a non-member function, and it will not allow you to then access data members inside of that function. The fact that its prototype exists inside of the function, the compiler could care less. As far as it's concerned, that function definition doesn't belong in that class. It's not going to compile it into that class. It's not going to let it access. It's not part of it. It assumes that it's an entirely separate function. Okay? Other questions? Alright, so like I said, we're going to keep this pretty simple right now. We're only going to use this primarily for constructors, and we're going to make sure that they have different numbers of parameters. So here on the next slide here, 23, the standard C++ language operators can also be overloaded. And this is very useful, very powerful, because basically it then allows us to use our class objects as though they were built right into the language. In the language, we can add two integers, we can add two reals. How do we do that? We use the plus operator. Well, wait a minute, the plus operator can be used with reals or integers? Yes, why? Because it's overloaded. It is actually invoking two separate instructions inside the processor. Processors have real addition instructions and they have integer addition functions. And the compiler figures out which one to call by the types of the parameters. Okay? That symbol, the plus symbol, is essentially overloaded. It stands for both real addition and it stands for integer addition. So we can basically overload a lot, not all, and I'm not going to bother with the list. You'll learn that next semester in 2704, which operators can be overloaded and which ones can't. We're going to stick with pretty much the basic standard operators in here, so we won't need to worry about that too much. But for example, if we wanted, instead of that compare function, to compare two date objects, it would be much more natural inside of our code if we could just, instead of saying like, if a date dot compared to b date or whatever, instead of doing that, if we could just say if a date equals b date, we can do that by using the operator keyword and overloading the equality operator. Basically, then what we do is inside of our date class header, we add that prototype up there. The equality operator returns a Boolean, right? So that's its return type. Then we use the keyword operator, and immediately following the keyword operator, we list the character, the operator symbol, that we're going to be overloading. So in this case, it's equal. And then in parentheses, we list the parameters. Well, now in this case, the equality operator is a binary operator. It takes two operands, right? One operand, by default, will be the invoking function, the invoking object. The object that is on the left-hand side of the equality operator. And then that means this thing only needs one explicit operand. And since it's not going to be making any changes to its parameter, to its operand, it can be passed as constant reference. And it should be passed by constant reference. Then down below where we have defined our member functions for the date class, we add a definition for the equality operator function overload. We say bool, the return type, then the name of the class, the scope resolution operator, and the rest of the function heading just follows exactly as we listed it above. And then in this case, that function is really just a one-line function. We're going to check to see if the day of the implicit operand, which is the invoking object, is equal to the other date.day is, and if the month is equal, and if the year is equal. So if all of that's true, we'll return true. We just made up a Boolean expression that's true if those two dates are true. So we return the true or false value of that Boolean expression. That then allows us to call the overloaded function by just saying if A date equals B date. Don't use the dot operator to invoke this function. Okay? Do not do something like if A date dot equal parentheses B date. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense and it's not necessary. The compiler essentially translates our expression into this for us anyway. Let's see here. Oh yeah, the B date, as you can tell here though from this, is the one that gets passed, the second operand is the one that gets passed as a parameter to the operator overload function. If we overload those relational operators, that basically would eliminate our need for that compare to function and the enum relational type that we created. But even if we do that, we really can't use one slight problem with this, not a big problem. If we did this way with the relational operators, it would mean that we, for example, just couldn't use it in a case tag. If we actually had the compared to function where we're returning a relation type, we could actually list those in a switch statement as case tags. Bad big deal. So we're giving up that one slight construct in the language. It's still much more natural to do it like this. Okay. Somebody back here had a question. Yes?
Can we close those operators without
involving classes? Yes, you can, but you must be very careful about doing that. Okay? You better have a darn good reason, and you better dig through the language manual, because you're basically then overloading the default call of that operator, okay? So you better be careful, and you can't do that for all operators. You can only do it for some. All right. In here, we're going to stick to just overloading them in a class. Now, we can also have, this gets a little bit more complicated, but it also gives us more power in terms of expressing and composing our classes. We can have what's called initialized parameters. In functions, in the function prototype, we can actually give default values for the parameters. We can tell the compiler that if this parameter, basically by giving it default initial value, we're basically telling the compiler that if this argument is omitted in the call, use this value. Okay? That allows the user of the class to then omit the argument. You've already been using this some. It's in the stream class. In the stream class, for example, there are several versions of the get function and the get line function. One of the versions of the get line function is to take three parameters, where the third parameter is the terminating character. And if you omit that, if you only pass it two parameters, it will automatically assume that you want to get the rest of the line, and that terminating character becomes the new line. Well, the way they've done that is basically by setting that third parameter in the function heading equal to the new line character. That means then that when you omit it, it automatically supplies it for you. In a sense, it automatically creates function overloading, because now you can invoke the same function with different numbers of parameters. So it's almost like in one function definition, you're giving it a couple definitions for a couple different overloads of the function. That's sort of the power of this. You can see here, in terms of the code for the constructor, the parameterized constructor of the date class that we've got up there, it hasn't really changed the code any at all. However, that means now that in terms of invoking the parameterized constructor, we can define a date with only two parameters. If we define it with only two parameters, it'll pick up the default date for the last one here, which is 1980. Or if we only give it one date, or one value, it'll pick up the default values for the last two. So this will become March 1st, 1980. Or if we omit all three, it picks up all three values. Those omitted values in the call have to be the rightmost arguments. We can't omit them to the left. This would give you an error down here at the bottom. There's also a few other little sort of rules of this. In the function prototypes, when we're giving the default argument, they also have to be the rightmost argument. In other words, what I've got up there would be an error if I tried to give a value to the first one and the last one, but not to the middle argument. It would be possible if I omitted, I could give default values for the last two, the rightmost two parameters, but not the first one. That would be acceptable. That would mean then, of course, that it would always have to be invoked with at least one argument, though, in that case. There are some guidelines for doing this. Both of those we've really just went over. There's default argument values in the prototype do have to be specified with constants. All those other two we've already went over. Now, in terms of using default arguments with constructors like this, we said that there can only be one parameterless constructor, which is called the default constructor, right? There can only be one of those, which makes sense, because if we had two constructors that took no parameters, they had no return type, it would mean they would be identical and the compiler couldn't figure out which one to call. Well, if we have a fully defaulted argument parameterized constructor like this one, in other words, we have a constructor, and in the prototype for that constructor, we give default argument values for each of its parameters. If we do that, that means that this constructor could be invoked with no parameters, and therefore it becomes the default constructor also. This is basically a way of specifying both a default constructor and a parameterized constructor in one function definition. Can save you quite a bit of coding. And that's the main purpose of this. And you just have to be a little bit careful in terms of using it, but it is highly useful, and it can reduce the size of code for your classes quite a bit. All right. Inline member functions. Were you? Probably not. It is possible in a function, in the function prototype, in a class declaration, to actually specify the function body. You can specify the function body right inside the class declaration. Usually you'll only want to do this if the function is a very small function and it only takes like one or two statements to execute it. What's the advantage of doing this? Well, it basically makes it an implied inline function. What's an inline function? Anybody know? That's right. It basically means that the calls to the function aren't really calls. The compiler replaces the calls to the function with the actual code of the function. It substitutes the parameters, substitutes the variables, basically, but it expands the call by actually putting the statements right there in place of the call. That means then that it avoids the overhead of a function call. And we'll talk a little bit later in the course about what the overhead of a function call is. But it avoids that, makes it execute a little bit faster. Of course, it also means that the overall size of your executable image will be a little bit larger now because you've duplicated those instructions everywhere else. As long as it's only one or two instructions, it's considered a good practice. It'll speed it up, it avoids the overhead call, and the avoiding the overhead call is about equivalent, because there has to be statements to do the call and then return back from the call. That is about equal to the expansion of the code by the statements inside of the function body. The And it doesn't really matter that the functions are defined first here and actually accessing the private data members, which are defined second, because they're all within the class and everything has class scope, that's okay. If you wanted to, you could actually avoid, avoid that consideration, of course, by defining the private data members first, but that's not a big deal. Okay. Structure charts and classes. How do we specify classes on structure charts? Well, first, for each of our classes, we make up what's called a class form. We list the name of the class, the purpose, we list its constructors, its mutators, its reporter functions, and the data members. We make up this little chart here, which basically is our documentation on the class. That gets included with the structure charts, although it's not actually part of the structure charts. And then in terms of representing calls to function members on the structure chart, we basically do this by, we still show the call to the function, but in order to indicate that that's a function that's a member of the class, on the function, on the structure chart, in the little rectangle for the function, we just prefix the name of the class and the scope resolution operator to that. We also will show the invoking object as an output or input. We also show the invoking object. So for this case here, complex 2 would be the invoking object. And this is returning back the modulus, which is C size, and we usually show the, if that's the return value, we usually show what it's being assigned to in the code. Here it's being that return value is being assigned to C size in the actual code. So we actually show the invoking object, which is an implicit parameter. We show that as a parameter on the structure chart. We also show, if there are any other parameters, of course, we also show those too. That's basically all there is in terms of indicating how objects and their functions are invoked on a structure chart. So, here on slide 29, is a sample little data, what's called a data class. A typical data class is a class that just contains simple data members, and it contains usually one or two simple constructors. It contains some reporter member functions, and it contains some mutator member functions. If you look, it doesn't contain dynamic memory. We're going to get into talking about dynamic memory and pointers on Tuesday in here. But you can see from this here, this is sort of keeping around inventory. That SKU string is sort of the stock unit number string. It's the key field. That's the field sort of that would correspond to our model field in the program that you're doing now. We said that there can never be two structures that exist in our current program that have the same model, but that model number has to be unique. And we're sorting upon that model number and ordering the array on that model number. So for that, because we're using that to order the array, that's usually referred to as the primary or field or the key field. And that means that we should not be able to change that easily, because if we accidentally change it and it's in an array which is sorted, we could destroy the ordering that's upon the, that we've maintained on the array. So for that reason, it's considered good class design if your key fields or primary fields do not have mutator functions. A data class will usually have a get function for each of the data members. And you can see we've got get functions here for each of those data members up there. They will also have mutator functions for every field except the key fields. The key fields are the primary fields that are the main field that you're doing your ordering upon. Like, for example, student records here at Virginia Tech. What do you think was probably the key field? Huh? Social Security number? And probably one other. PID. Okay? Those, they're not going to allow to be changed without a lot of difficulty. Those are usually sometimes referred to as immutable fields. You want to make them difficult to change, difficult to mutate them. And so we just don't include mutator functions, set functions for those. That would mean to actually change one. If we had an array of these inventory items, we had an array of these objects, and we order those on the SKU. And then later at some point in our code, we decide we need to change the SKU for one of them. What would we have to do? Well, we couldn't just say set SKU for that object. What we would have to do is we would first have to create an entirely new object, an entirely new inventory item object with the new SKU. And maybe the rest of the information, and then we would have to reassign it to physically replace the other object. We would not be able to just tell the other object to change its SKU. That way, by forcing ourselves, since we're also the designer of our class, by forcing ourselves to go through this extra step or two, we ensure that when we do change it, we're more conscious of it, and we're less likely to make a mistake. Now, in reality, you would also want to do this. This is actually more important when you're a part of a programming team, and you want to make sure that if your users are changing certain values, that they're aware that these values are being used, you know, for primary ordering or key ordering, and therefore you make them go through a couple extra steps in order to change it. If we look at the rest of this class here, it's pretty straightforward. Let me back up. The constructors, you can see there's a default constructor and then there's a parameterized constructor, which has values for each. The parameterized constructor just has values for each of those fields. And of course, I could have combined those two constructors into one. If we look here on the next slide, we look at the two constructors. The default constructor there just assigns each of the fields some default value. And the parameterized constructor just assigns the fields here to the values that's been passed in. Now, in reality, one of the things you would want to do in a parameterized constructor like this is do a good bit of error checking to make sure that these values that the user has passed in are valid values to be assigned. Okay? I haven't bothered to put that in here. Now, I could, of course, just combine these two by doing what? I could have combined those two constructors into one by using what mechanism? Default argument values for the parameters. Okay? I could have actually listed default argument values out here for each of these and then done away with the default constructor. And you can see here are the reporter functions. The reporter functions are all constant member functions, and all they do is return back the corresponding data member. And here are the mutator functions. The mutator functions are not constant member functions because they're going to be changing the corresponding data member of the class, and that's all they do. They set the corresponding data member that they're named to the parameter that's being passed in to them. And that's it. We're done for the day, and we'll stop there. We'll pick up with pointers on Tuesday.